Good evening, everybody. And I'm delighted to have a chat with Barry about his book. I came across this book, actually, in the Hay Festival last May. It was a conversation with Nick Gowing. And the audience, I think we had about 2,000 persons present, full of enthusiasm. And since then, Barry has been on the road. It's like stars, rock singers, moving from one place to another place to another place. He has been lecturing about the book in many universities. He has been in many book fairs. His last talk was last week in Sawas.
Yeah, it was at Sawas, yeah.
So I would say he has been all over the Middle East. He's got invitations in North America, though the Americans are reluctant to give him a visa. I don't know why. Journalists are not prophets, actually. They just report events. But very few can predict events. And I think Barry is the leader of those who have managed over the last 30 years as a journalist, as a prolific writer, to predict events. And one of the events is the emergence of the Islamic State. This was predicted by Barry.
When I wrote the book after Bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, the next generation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also he anticipated the expansion of Al-Qaeda and the emergence of many non-state actors. Barry, perhaps you can give us some sort of summary about the main themes of the book, as you see it yourself.
Thank you, Professor Ayad. I'm also very thankful to Mosaic Room to invite me to meet this distinguished audience. It is my pleasure to be here. Thank you for coming, and I hope I can shed some lights on this, the most dangerous phenomena in our era. When I say the most dangerous phenomena, you know, if you want to see how dangerous is it, you must look at its enemies. When this Islamic State, you know, has more than 100 enemies, including three superpowers, United States, Russia and China, and several semi-superpowers like France and Britain and Germany, and a regional superpower like Saudi Arabia and Iran, who they never agreed on one thing, but they actually, Iran and Saudi Arabia, for the first time, they are agreeing on their hatred and their desire to fight and root out this phenomenon. So this is how this actually phenomena is very important. It has a lot of enemies, you know, and it has at least, until now, 8,000 air sorties by the most advanced warplane to destroy it. So you can see how dangerous this phenomena. And you know, there are conference after conference. You can see the odds sitting together in Vienna, before that in Geneva, to try to actually find a solution. And I will talk about how, whether actually they will succeed in finding a way to actually, as I said, root out of this phenomenon. This is one thing that we have to look at, how this Islamic State was created and how it was, you know, emerged as the way it is now. Let's say that if we go back to the American intervention in Iraq, military intervention, many people, actually, we in the Middle East, we are fond of the conspiracy theory. Usually, you know, suddenly on the internet, immediately, in 2 years' time, we are faced by, you know, this Islamic State. And so a lot of stories on the internet, on the social media, the Facebook in particular, some of them say, oh, it is an Israeli creation. Other people saying, no, it is American creation. Third people, no, it is our Wahhabi creation. So there were a lot of, actually, theories, but most of it, actually, just fictions. Nobody actually tried to look at the roots of this, how this actually was created. Before we go that to that roots, actually, I would like you to remember six key words. If you actually look at these six key words, you will understand why this phenomena is very dangerous and how to understand it. So the six key words is humiliation, frustration, marginalization, lack of good governance, foreign military intervention, and the social media. These are the six key words which can explain why actually and answer all the question why and how and where and who, you know, in relating to the Islamic State.
The first one
is humiliation. Arab are really, and Muslims are humiliated in the last, say, you know, a quarter of a century by foreign intervention, the Israeli occupation, you name it. Frustration, we have actually in the Middle East 60% of our people under the age of 27. 60%. We have a generation unemployed and no hope at all, no good education, no future. So this is the frustration. We have a frustrated generation. And the third word is marginalization. Now we are facing a sectarian division, the Sunni and the Shia. We have also ethnic divisions, the Arabs and non-Arabs. And both of them, both very, very dangerous. So this lead to marginalization. If the Shia are in power, they marginalize, unfortunately, the Sunni. If the Sunni in power, they marginalize the Shia. And this creates a lot of resentment on our part of the world. So lack of good governance, actually, you can see how you know, we don't have proper democracy. We don't have good governance. What we have, either dictatorship or actually, you know, these monarchies, again, you know, dictator monarchies ruling us. Or actually we have old people, like for Bouteflika, for example, or you know, King of Saudi Arabia, and you know, some of them got Alzheimer's, some of them are crippled completely. So this is another problem we're facing. This is the lack of good governance. Have you seen somebody ruling a country from his wheelchair? You know, it happens in our part of the world. Bourguiba is running the country from his wheelchair. And he never actually faced his people. He never gave a public speeches for the last 2 years or so. So this gives you... And we had a lot of stories that King Salman of Saudi Arabia, he got Alzheimer. So imagine, and you know, it's endless example. The fifth point is foreign military intervention. This kind of military intervention, whether in Iraq, whether in Libya, whether in Syria, wherever, what they do, they create failed states. We have failed states now in the Middle East. We have a failed state in Iraq. We have a failed state in Libya. We have a failed state in Yemen. We have a failed state in Somalia. And God knows how many we will have as long as this military intervention is taking place. The sixth point is the social media. The social media is extremely important. That's why I called my book, actually, Islamic State, the Digital Caliphate. Why it is important? Despite the Islamic State hate the West, and they want to destroy the West, but actually they are the greatest beneficiary of the social media or the invention of the West. When I say social media, now, you know, they are different from Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda, when during Osama bin Laden time, an old man, sitting in front of a camera and talking for about 1 hour, recording his speech in a videotape and begging Al Jazeera or CNN to show it. Now those people, they don't need so. They don't have to do so. They go to the social media, they go to the internet, they go to Facebook, they go to, you know, to whatever. You know, they have their own media arms, and I will talk about it. So this is how it's a press of a button, and they reach all the corners of the world. They reach millions, maybe ten of millions of people, especially young people. And again, it is extremely important. Now, to go back to how this actually phenomena started, it is, you know, many people suddenly in 2 years, you know, they managed to capture Raqqa in Syria and most of Deir ez-Zor, a great deal of Aleppo, and suddenly they moved to Iraq. They managed to capture Mosul, which is the second biggest city in Iraq, and after that Ramadi, and after that Palmyra, when the West of them, you know, the American expert, military expert, saying we managed actually to reduce the venom, we managed to contain them, suddenly they occupied two major cities, Ramadi in Iraq, and then Palmyra in Syria. So it shows you, after 6,000 air sorties, they managed to occupy or actually capture Palmyra and in Syria and Ramadi in Iraq. So many people actually underestimate from the day one the strength of this phenomenon. While they were actually looking at Syrian situation, they want to topple Bashar al-Assad of Syria, they did not pay attention to this phenomena, which was actually starting to grow and grow and grow. They poured billions of money, of dollars, in Syria to quicken the collapse of the Assad regime. And actually they did not also pay attention to what is happening inside Syria itself. Again, I would like to give you another terminology which is extremely important. This is when I say this is the most dangerous phenomena in our part of the world for many reasons. First, an Islamic State is self-sufficient financially. Self-sufficient financially. When I say self-sufficient financially, they managed to loot $500 million from the Iraqi central bank branch in Mosul. And they used to export equal of at least $3 million a day of oil to the neighboring countries. When people used to, when the prices of oil used to be about $118 a barrel or $120 a barrel, they used to sell it for $50. Definitely, if you are giving 50% discount, you will find a lot of buyers. The Syrian regime used to buy oil from them. The Kurdish enclave in Kurdistan, in north of Iraq, used to buy oil from them. Turkey also, or Turkish traders, used to buy oil from them. So they accumulated, you know, between $4 billion to $7 billion.
Even Assad himself is buying oil from them.
Yes, he is, yes. This is the irony. Because it's cheap, and you know, you want to buy. And usually, for example, it's very easy to smuggle. For example, we have read 85% of the drugs in this country are coming from Afghanistan. For all the way. So usually when, you know, you have smugglers, no problem. So, and when you offer your goods actually in cheap prices and a huge discount, definitely you will find buyers. So it is self-sufficient financially, and it is self-sufficient military-wise. When I say, you know, when they captured Raqqa and part of Deir ez-Zor and Azaz in north west Syria, so they got Russian armies from the Syrian army warehouses, military warehouses or dumps. So, and when they invaded and occupied or regained or controlled Mosul, they put their hands on American, the most sophisticated American arms, which used to be possessed by the Iraqi army. So, you know, there were about $27 billion spent on arming and training the Iraqi army. And 30,000 soldiers ran away immediately when they heard that Islamic State is coming. So, So they are self-sufficient financially, and they are self-sufficient military-wise. The third thing, which is extremely important from any other organization, most of other organizations used to live in the nation or certain regional donors or backers or, for example, the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, they used to be backed by the American, by the Saudi, by the Gulf states. Osama bin Laden, the leader of Al-Qaeda, he also used to be backed by some wealthy Arabs in Saudi Arabia and the Gulf region, also by his family wealth. But when it comes to the Islamic State, they are fully independent. They don't want anybody to back them. Already they have self-sufficient, as I said, arms and also money. The other important, the other point, which is extremely important, they are not a guest of anybody. They have their own territory, which is bigger than Britain. And they have their own people. And, and I will tell you whether it is a state or not. Many people say it's not Islamic and it's not state. I will explain that later. But, so, they have their own territory. Al-Qaeda used to be a guest of Taliban. And a guest of Sudan. So they can, Taliban can say to Osama bin Laden, thank you very much, we don't want you, please leave. But those people, you cannot say to them, just leave, because they are sovereign in their territories. With how long this sovereignty will last, nobody can tell. But until now, they have this sovereignty.
Okay, you're talking about Islamic State as de facto state, with all the ingredients of a nation state. Do you think, how long would it take for the international community to recognize the Islamic State as de jure, hence becoming member, respectable member of the UN? And we know at the UN, most of them started as rogue states, pariahs, and criminals, terrorists, etc. And now they are respectable members of the UN.
So how long do you think would it be
a year, 5 years, 10 years?
But before I come to this, I would like to explain. When I said there is a huge underestimation of those people, many people think that they have a dirty beard and a baggy trousers, and they are willing to kill, and they don't know who are they until recently. When I actually wrote this book, and the first edition, it was in Arabic, simply because here a lot of routines until you publish your book in English. So I started with the Arabic one. Many people were amazed. I came out with a theory that, those people are not stupid. When I say they are not stupid, they are actually, most of them, coming originally from Saddam Hussein Republican Guards. Military establishment of Saddam Hussein, the army of Saddam Hussein, young colonels, young officers. So the Mukhabarat, and we have to remember that when Saddam Hussein realized that the American will invade Iraq, and they divided it to no-fly zone in the north and no-fly zone in the south, he realized that the next step is to invade Iraq, occupy it, and to change his regime. What he did? He's supposed to be a secular, a Baathist. The first thing he did, actually, he closed all the nightclubs and he banned alcohol. And he started praying. He wrote his, Allahu Akbar on the Iraqi flag by his blood. I don't know whether this is true or not, but that's the story we were given. And actually, as I said, he started the faith campaign and urging people to convert to Islam. So from a secular to Islamist. And this was the turning point, this one thing. The American occupation of Iraq, what happened? They dissolved the Iraqi army. They dissolved all the institutions, the Mukhabarat, the intelligence service, and everything, the Republican of God, and under the name of de-Baathification. And those people were dumped in the streets. No future, no salaries, humiliated. Remember I said humiliation. Started with humiliation. They were humiliated. And so they are extremely frustrated. So, maybe if somebody, for example, in our community here, the Muslim community, the Arab communities, if you know you're divorced, your wife divorced you, or your girlfriend friend actually left you, or go out with somebody else, most of the people, what they do, they convert to Islam. Some of them actually. And if you go to Regent Park, you'll find those young people in the corners and reading Quran and are very humble. Look, so this is the seeds of the Islamic State, the humiliation. Those people, about a million of those people, were humiliated and dumped. No future at all. So they, and also they were tortured on Abu Ghraib prison, and also tortured on Buka prison. Personally, when I was researching this book, I met somebody who was imprisoned with Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of the Islamic State, on the same cell in Buka prison. And he told me how actually the Ba'athist and the Islamist met together, joined together, and from there the seeds of Islamic State was sown. And from there it's actually emerged. So when I say, you know, ex-Ba'athist, ex-Saddam Hussein army colonels, because those people with dirty beard, with baggy trousers, they wouldn't go and, you know, put plans to capture a huge city like Mosul. They wouldn't know how to ride tanks. Imagine somebody from London, for example, and going to Islamic State and driving, go, hey, here I am, you know, in the tanks or using missiles. And so they are expert. And so when we talk about the state, Professor Ayad asked, yes, it is a de facto state. It is actually all that description or terminology of the United Nations or international law about a state apply to the Islamic State. They have their police, they have the army, they have ministry, they have a full cabinet, they have health service, they have water service, they have electricity, they have all the services. So you can't say suddenly, you know, you have people in 2 years actually, or less than a year actually, manage to run all these services. In this country, after 500 or 600 years, and still the health service is very bad. So imagine if those people just suddenly, because they are experts, they are not actually stupid. This is the difference. You know, this is what I mean by the underestimation of those people. And when it comes to the media, which is why I call it digital caliphate. Anyway, so even they have their own currency now, they have their dinar. They have a radio station called Bayan. They have a television station called Al-Tawheed. And they have a huge media arm.
And they have a capital?
And they have a capital. They have, you know.
Why did they choose Raqqa?
You know, even, you know, everything is, you know, well calculated by them. Why they choose Raqqa as their temporary capital? Because their actually permanent capital should be Mecca. So which they choose Raqqa, because Raqqa used to be the summer capital of Harun al-Rashid, the caliphate, the well-known caliphate of Abbasid Empire. So that was, you know, they choose it because they calculate everything. So Raqqa was chosen, not Mosul. You know, Mosul is much bigger than Raqqa. But they choose Raqqa because the symbolic status of it as ex-capital or the summer capital of Harun al-Rashid. So they are well established, and it is a state. Now, you know, maybe through my own research also, if you notice, you know, a lot of Syrian, you know, about 80% or 85% of the Syrian immigrants to Europe, you see them in the boats, and you see 85% of them coming where? From either areas controlled by the regime or areas controlled by the opposition, armed opposition. Very few of them coming from the Islamic State. Very, very few. You know, there is a counter-immigration to the Islamic State. You know, there are people coming and joining the Islamic State from most of the Muslim world countries. So, you know, to see the paradox here, you know, why they are different and they are dangerous, you know, talking about it.
You're not encouraging the audience, are you?
No. I don't encourage anybody. Maybe I will join them. I received a tweet on my Twitter account, somebody offering me a job to be editor of their magazine, Dabaq. Yes. Definitely, I turned down the offer. I didn't answer it. So imagine me editing that Dabaq magazine of the Islamic State. So, and you know, so this is the other point I would like to talk about is, so I leave you if you want to ask any question. I wouldn't. I would like to talk about two things. Why I call it the digital caliphate, and why actually is and what's the future, as Professor Ayad asked.
Sorry, would you explain the Arabic version? You talk about roots, savagery, and future.
Yeah.
What do you mean by savagery? Why did you choose that word?
Yeah.
Savagery.
Savagery
in Arabic is tawahush. It's like savage.
You know, because if you want to know the Islamic State, you have to know these three things, three terminologies. The roots, which I talked about briefly. I don't want to say everything because I hope you will buy the book, you know. Because not me, it is, you know, the publisher who organized this event in order to sell books, not to, yeah. So when I talked about the root, the savagery is integral part of the Islamic State. When I say integral part, they deliberately use savagery, and they have a thinker who actually, Abu Bakr al-Naji, who put this theory in 2003, that the management of savagery, Idarat al-Tawahush. Why they use it? They use it actually in order to terrorize their enemy, to give the repetition that there are, you know, anybody who's against them will be beheaded completely and burned to death. And they are very, very brutal. And they are actually following the steps of many revolutions before them, whether Islamic or non-Islamic, the Mughal, the Tatars, even Stalin. He massacred 20 million Russian in the beginning of the revolution. Communism revolution or communist revolution. The same thing in this country, Cromwell, when actually he toppled the monarchy, he massacred 400,000 Brits. If you go back to the history, you will find it. Savagery is not the Abbasid, the Umayyad. You know, it is even French Revolution. After the French Revolution succeeded, what happened? They massacred 150,000. So this is in history, and those people, they did read history very well. Whether Islamic history, which is, you know, certain phases of it was bloody, and we know, you know, I don't want to go into details of that. So savagery is integral part of their strategy to frighten people. That's why the Iraqi army, when they knew they are coming, you know, they just left their weapons and they ran away for life. They because of the fear, terrorism. And it worked for them, and it is working, and they know how actually to spread it, and I will explain it on the, when I talk about the media, how they actually manipulating the media and use it for their own interest. So savagery is part, integral part of their strategy, and they do it in order to terrorize people. You know, you can't train any conscript, any soldier, how to shoot, how actually to put plans, how to attack. But, you know, there are one thing, or there is one thing you cannot train them to do, which is how to blow yourself up. How to blow up yourself. How to go and, you know, just like today, for example, before we came to this lecture, there was two suicide attacks on Lebanon, on the southern province of Beirut. So you can see, you know, just they go, have the explosive belt and blow themselves up. Or they can fight until, you know, or, you know, drive a van full of explosion to this building or that building or this army post. Or that's the only thing which you cannot train your soldier actually. They do train their people. They have a huge queue of those people who would like to blow themselves up on the name of Islam. How they brainwash them, it is, you know, because they implement or they teach Wahhabism. You know, they teach Muhammad bin Abdul Wahhab and bin Taymiyyah teaching. So this is a very, very dangerous, very radical interpretation of Islam. So this is the surgery. You know, talk about the media, how they implement the media. They are very, very efficient in actually manipulating the social media in particular. They have special people on the Facebook, on Twitter, on Snapchat, whatever, on the internet. And they are working, using the social media for recruitment. They are extremely successful. They have about more than, you know, 70,000 accounts on the Twitter. They have at least 120,000 tweets every day. So you can see how. And they have thousands of websites on the internet. So they are using the social media to their benefit. And they have experts on the media. They have three media arms, very, very strong and very sophisticated. They have Al-Ittisam, they have Al-Furqan, and they have Al-Hayat. And the people working there, most of the people actually working there simply because they are convinced they are doing it under the name of Islam. So, and the irony is, you know, the head of these media arms, all of it, he is Ahmed Abu Samra. He was born on France, Paris, and he was educated on the United States, and he got his BA in IT technology or IT engineering. So they are, and he managed to recruit a lot of his colleagues. Maybe somebody will ask, you know, why those young people in this country who are living a very nice way of life, very luxury way of life, high education, very good democracy, as they call it. Why they go and join the Islamic State? Why, you know, girls, Muslim girls, beautiful, very stable family, they leave their family and go to see Turkey, and from Turkey cross the border to join the Islamic State? I'm saying, you know, there are a lot of exaggeration about this. You know, people who go and join them, they are most of them recruited by the propaganda of the Islamic State on the social media, because there are chat rooms, people who join. And as I said, they are the minority of the minority. You know, we don't have thousands of British girls, for example, going to join the Islamic State. We don't have thousands of, you know, young Muslims in this country going to join the Islamic State. But it is, you know, this kind of phenomena is very attractive to many young people. Why it is attractive? I have a son who is 15 years of age. When he was 13, I want to see his games, you know, the computer games he actually looking at. I was really shocked. It is very bloody. You know, I said, look, this is too blood everywhere on the screen. You know, they are attracted to blood. You know, they want to kill. Kill the enemy. Oh, wow. He's very, very, very enthusiastic.
The son of Count Dracula.
Yeah, exactly. So this is, you know, saying. And also, by the way, you know, some women, some girls are attractive to those young men there. By the way, they are very handsome. They are very handsome. Mm-hmm. British women, I remember I was, when 11th of September took place, when 11th of September took place, I was, you know, everywhere on the media here, the Sky News, BBC, you name it, anyway. And I was really shocked when I have read. I thought I'm very handsome and very smart. And, you know, there was a survey, and the Daily Telegraph published it. The Daily Telegraph was a very conservative newspaper. Said, you know, about 85% of British women consider Osama bin Laden is the sexiest man on earth. Honestly, if you go to 2001 and look at the Daily Telegraph, I don't know whether it's in Google or not, you know, seriously, if he was voted the sexiest man on earth, you know, tall, nice, and despite being a terrorist. So sometimes women are attracted, some women, I don't know, you know, I hope my wife is not attracted to this. So they are attracted to this. Again, you know, in our generation, When I was a teenager, this was about 2,000 years ago. You know, what kind of films we used to go to? You know, cowboys. You remember? I don't know. Maybe people in my age will remember how Steve McQueen, the Magnificent Seven, when he's putting the gun and naked chest, and you know. So people like that. You know, this image is so. It's whether we like it or not. This is the fact. So anyway, so they are attracted. Some people, young people, attracted to those people. And also they are telling them that Islamic State propaganda that, you know, they are actually going to live under the Sharia law, the real Islamic State. Some people are attracted for this, you know, again, because of frustration, because unemployment, humiliation, the six key words which I mentioned at the beginning. So, talking about the media, they produce a very sophisticated documentaries. You know, they have long documentaries, they have short documentaries, medium, and they have shorts. And those people are working, you know, the expert behind their media arms, they are working, and, you know, to be honest, when you go and look at it, they manage to outfox Hollywood itself. Very, very good production, because they were educated in the Western world. They are not educated on Middle East and Al-Azhar, for example, university. Or no, they were educated in Britain. They were educated in the United States, in Germany. So they brought this experience, or take this experience, to the Islamic State. And they orchestrate everything. For example, when they burned the pilot, Jordanian pilot Maad al-Khatib, who his plane, whether for a mechanical fault or was downed by Islamic State, you know, they put him in the cage, an orange suit, like Guantanamo. And, you know, somebody with a torch, like bam, bam, and music, you know, very, very scary music. And he actually light that fire. And, you know, we can see, you know, it's with the music behind it. So they do it. They know. Sorry?
Was that real? Because they said it wasn't real.
It was real.
Well, it was, yeah.
Yes, definitely, he died. So they knew, they want to inflict the maximum of terror on other people, on their enemies. The maximum of terror. Right. I will talk about the future, just to then leave you the floor for you to send some questions, ask some questions. What's the future of this state? Is it going to survive? If you listen to the American generals, they are saying that it could be with us for 30 years. Is it going to be recognized? There are, you know, two theories. See, there are people who are talking about we must destroy them. And the Russian and the American agreed, you know, that this is very dangerous for all of us, for the international community, so we have threw them out completely, and no mercy with them. There is other school of thought saying, no, we cannot actually root them out. It will be very, very expensive, very costly in human terms. So why did we contain them? And containment could be a possibility. I'll give you one example. 5 years ago, I was invited to lecture tours in Canada, and I bought the magazine, well-known magazine, Foreign Affairs. And you know, everybody in that time, everybody, was talking about a war to destroy Iran's nuclear ambition and nuclear establishment. Everybody was talking about four aircraft carriers, Western aircraft carriers in the Gulf. And, you know, a lot of more than 200 warships there. And so we were waiting that, you know, for the trigger to ignite the war against Iran. So it was well prepared, and they sold more than $2 billion of sophisticated arms to the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, Dhabi, United Arab Emirates, and Qatar, in order, in preparation for this war against Iran. When I read that, you know, magazine by very distinguished scholars, you know, they said, you know, we have two options, either to attack Iran or to contain it. And I was really surprised. Everybody was talking about containment of Iran. I said, my God, containment of Iran? And look what happened now. they contain Iran. Iran actually is they signed an agreement with Iran. So, and no confrontation, because Iran is very difficult to defeat. So, I'm not saying that Islamic State like Iran, but containment could be a possibility in a way or another. They managed actually to contain Taliban. And now, after 13 years or 14 years of war against Taliban and bombardments, you know, and there's 50,000 soldiers of NATO there, after 14 years, now they are talking to Taliban. So they talk to the IRA in this country. And even in a certain stage, there was a school of thought that we should talk to Osama bin Laden. So we don't know whether it will, you know, be contained, recognized. I don't know. We have to wait and see. But it is a possibility. We cannot actually exclude it completely. Also, other thing which I would like to talk about is, you know, they are ambitious. They want to establish their caliphate from actually Uyghur province in China to maybe Vienna, or more than that, maybe to London. We don't know. Are they going to achieve this? You know, if you look at the realities, it is extremely difficult. But they are, you know, different from Al-Qaeda. They don't want to take revenge. Al-Qaeda used to send people to actually blow up a plane, attack the World Trade Center. But those people, they are not interested in taking revenge. They are interested in grabbing lands and expand.
With the exception of the Russian plane.
Sorry?
With the exception of the Russian plane.
The Russian plane is a new phenomenon. That's because they actually they are interested in opening branches, franchises. You know, they have now the second stage. They established their state, or actually the mini state in or de facto state in Syria, half of Syria and half of Iraq. Now people start to come to them saying, "We want to join you." Sinai, Sinai was actually under the activities of Ansar Bayt al-Maqdis. And suddenly they were impressed with the Islamic State and they paid bay'ah or allegiances to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi and became part of it. And there is al-Shabaab of Somalia who also paid allegiances to Islamic State. In Libya there is Emirates or another province of Islamic State in Darna and also in Sirte and in Jufra in the south. So they are expanding, and also now they are open another branch in Afghanistan, another one in Pakistan. So they want to expand. And these kind of provinces are working for them. And the downing of the Russian airplane actually was by the Sinai province. But you know, for them, maybe they will, you know, later. But this is the first part, and it shocked many people because it was very, very sophisticated way. There is a bomb, and this bomb explodes when the aircraft reach, you know, 30,000 feet. Yeah, but so it means they have people who knows what they are doing. So the other danger of this state, you know, they could use chemical weapons. This is the most dangerous thing. They can manufacture it and they can use it, because they have Saddam Hussein expert, they have Syrian expert also, they have Chechen expert in their ranks, and they could either manufacture it, or actually they could have it from the Syrian warehouses, because you know when the Syrian left, Deir ez-Zor and Raqqa and Homs in certain stages were part of Homs. You know, their warehouses were full of these tanks of chemical weapons. So they wouldn't hesitate to use it. This is the most dangerous thing. And this could be a deterrent. I don't know. Because, you know, it's very lethal. And it is, as I said, they don't care. As they told me, we don't have anything to lose. If the Arab governments are coward to use it against the Israeli, they have chemical weapons, biological weapons, they were coward to use it against the Israeli, we will use it. What are we scared of? So, I conclude by saying it is actually extremely dangerous, ruthless, brutal, barbaric organization. So, what will happen? God knows what will happen. Now they are getting together, the Russian, the American, the Chinese, the regional powers, in order to see what we can do about it. Without boots at the ground, they will never defeat it. But boots on the ground, who is willing to send their troops to fight this Islamic State and, you know, losing thousands of soldiers, for example, in this confrontation with them? This is the biggest question. I don't think the American will do. I don't think the British will do. I don't think Saudi Arabia and other Arab governments will do. You know, they sent few thousand to Yemen, and actually until now, after 8 months of bombing the poorest country on earth, and poorest in all fields. There is no military equipment, there is no sophistication, nothing at all. And they could not actually keep or control Aden or enter Sana'a or capture Sana'a. This is the problem. When you are in your own territory, it is very difficult to be defeated. So this is, that's why, and it's true, maybe there is no jungle in Iraq. There is no mountains in Syria, for example, east of Syria. But there are cement jungles in these cities there, and they are using it. And also, I don't believe now they need any support from outside, as I said, because they have weapons and they have money. And, you know, they don't have 10 Downing Street. They don't have, like Arab rulers, you know, luxury boats in the Mediterranean. And they don't have private jets. And they don't have, so they don't need a lot of money. Now they are imposing taxes, as they call it, mukus. And they are actually, and some of the people actually against them, they wouldn't like their rule. But what they did, they actually provide people with law and order, with security. It's brutal security, but it is much better than the anarchy in other places. And the irony is, and excuse me of saying it, the Islamic State may be the most secure part of the Eastern, of the Middle East. If in comparison with their surrounding, in comparison with Iraq, you know, in comparison with Syria, in comparison even with Afghanistan, in comparison with East Turkey, maybe they are the most secure part of the Middle East. And that's why I believe they are the most dangerous. Thank you very much.